It is my pleasure to introduce Rabbi Shai Schechter, Rosh Beit Midrash of the Young Israel of Woodmere.
Okay, good evening, everybody, and it is such a pleasure to be back learning with all of you. Unfortunately, we're unable to do it in person as of yet, but we are at least able to see each other and to learn together this evening. If I can just make a request that all those who are wearing clothing, maybe if you would be so kind as to turn on your screens, I find it much more enjoyable for us to all be at least learning together by seeing each other's faces and by joining together as best as we can. So I'm going to post something in the chat here just so that everybody can follow along. It's the only source that you will need, and you can follow along. That is really the main source that we're going to be discussing. So welcome to all of you, and I thank Menachem and the whole staff at REITS for putting this wonderful evening together. I feel badly for all those who are with us. You're missing out on some really great presentations, and I assume that's where everybody else is. But I would imagine that Menachem will make us have the availability after we're done to hear everybody else and to enjoy all of the wonderful shiurim that will be shared this evening. There are a number of different names that are given to the holiday of Shavuos. And if you look in the pages of Chumash, we know that Shavuos is referred to as Chag HaBikurim. Shavuos is the time when we celebrate the farmers bringing up their offering, their first fruits that grew in their produce. They would bring it up to the Beis HaMikdash, they would bring it up to Yerushalayim, and they would offer it to the Kohen as some kind of very special ceremony. And that's really what I want to focus on. Although probably you're wondering that would seem to be a very distant mitzvah. It's a commandment that we don't really have such a connection to. After all, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. We don't really have farmers on this call who are living in Eretz Yisrael. So you'll ask yourself, why is the topic of conversation tonight about something that is completely irrelevant? And you'll see as we go through this evening's shiur, you'll begin to understand and appreciate how relevant it is and how important it is to learn from some of the lessons that we can take from this important mitzvah of Bikurim. So let us get right into it. We look at the Mishnah. If all of you want to look at what was posted in the chat, I'll just post it one more time for all those who may have just come on. We only have one source this evening that we're all going to be following together. You can look there on the side in the chat and you can see it. And that is a quote from a Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim. And the Mishnah there gives a description about the farmers who used to take their first fruits that grew in their farms, and they would travel all the way to Yerushalayim. Now imagine in your mind, how far is it nowadays to travel from the Negev or from the Galil to Yerushalayim? It's not that far. It doesn't take that long. But in the days of the Gemara, certainly in the days of the Chumash, it used to take a very long time for a farmer to be able to get from one side of the country to the other. It was not as simple as it is today. And we have to keep that in mind as we go through the study of this Mishnah. So the Mishnah tells us that they would come to Yerushalayim, and they would have a big commotion, a lot of fanfare that happened around this ceremony of offering the Bikurim. And as we're told, they would come with a bunch of animals, and they would adorn the animals by putting gold around their heads, and they would have leaves that were adorning the animals all around. And then they would have a big marching band with flutes and drums that would go in front of all of these farmers, and they would have a big parade, a big procession, until they came to Yerushalayim. Finally, they get to Yerushalayim, and the Mishnah tells us, Higiu karov li Yerushalayim, shalchu lifneim. They used to send messengers, they used to send all kinds of couriers up to Yerushalayim, that people there should be informed that they are about to have the pleasure of welcoming the farmers who have come from very far away. And then the Mishnah says something very strange. Lefi kavod hanichnasim hayu yotzim. It was commensurate with the amount of honor or dignity that a farmer had. That is the kind of reception that he would receive. And then the Mishnah goes on to tell us that all the shopkeepers and the vendors and all the merchants of Yerushalayim would come out into the streets and they would bless them. But the Mishnah here focuses on the fact that if they were prominent farmers, if they were well known, if they were important and distinguished individuals, then they would get a very impressive reception. But if not, it seems that they got one that was far more subdued. So let's begin to break down some of the things that we find in this Mishnah. Number one, it's curious. You have a number of farmers that are coming to Yerushalayim to give their first fruits that grew. And they offer them to the Kohen in the Beis HaMikdash. And we all have to go out of our way, all the inhabitants of Yerushalayim, stand up for them, leave their shops, make a whole procession. What is that all about? Why do we do that? And the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin wonders why it is that we would do such a thing. Why does it deserve such a reaction, such a response? And the answer that the Gemara gives is twofold. Number one, says the Gemara, we need to appreciate the fact that this was a cumbersome and difficult mitzvah to observe. There was tremendous expense. There was an expenditure that was important in order for the farmer to be able to do his job of going up to Yerushalayim. He had to take off a week of work. He had to find somebody to travel with. He had to bring all the fruits with him. This was a stressful time. This was a major endeavor for a farmer in those days. And therefore, we want to be able to encourage him. We want him to feel good about what it is that he's doing, about the mitzvah that he's engaged in. And in fact, the way that we do that is by asking all of the shopkeepers, all of the members of the city of Yerushalayim to encourage by coming out of the store, by showing respect and honor to the one who has come so far to do his special mitzvah of bringing Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, this is something that is extremely relevant lehalacha today. How is it relevant? I would venture to say most of us who are here on the call probably have never brought Bikurim before. At least I hope you haven't, because there's no Beis HaMikdash to bring it to. So we have not performed the mitzvah. So how is this relevant? It's relevant in the following way. We have a Gemara Maseches Yuma, where the Gemara talks about Minayin lepikuach nefesh shedocha es haShabbos. How does one know that when they are observing Shabbos and a life-threatening situation presents itself, how do you know that you are to violate the Shabbos and do whatever it takes to save the life? How does one know? Maybe Shabbos is far more important than saving lives. And the answer that the Gemara comes to the conclusion is, after all, we have an edict in the Torah which states, V'chai bahem. V'chai bahem means that the most important principle in all of Judaism is that we need to save lives. And therefore, that would override even Shabbos. It would override almost everything else. We have to make sure that we do whatever we can to preserve life. And therefore, it means, even if Shabbos is going to pay the price, that is the price that we have to be willing to pay. Shabbos is pushed to the wayside because human life is far more important even than Shabbos itself. And the Gemara then goes further and says, even if it is a suffek pikuach nefesh, even if I am not sure whether someone's life is in danger, and I have to err on the side of caution, still, says the Gemara, I should err on the side of caution instead of upholding the Shabbos. So I would drive to the hospital on Shabbos, even if I am unsure whether somebody's in a life-threatening situation, because I want to make sure that I preserve human life. I want to make sure to do whatever I can to ensure that nobody's life will ever be put in danger. So much so that the Shulchan Aruch has an amazing comment. It's a frightening comment, but the Shulchan Aruch says, what if a life-threatening situation presents itself on Shabbos, and I go quickly, instead of running to the car and to the hospital or to call the ambulance, instead of doing that, I run to the rabbi's house to ask whether or not I'm allowed to go to the hospital. The Gemara says, it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, HaShoel HaReze Shofech Damim. If instead of running to the hospital, you run to ask the rabbi the question, you are tantamount to Shvichas Damim. Because seconds count. I see we have at least one doctor on the line with us. And when you have a situation like that, any doctor can tell us that seconds can sometimes mean the difference between life and death. And therefore, yes, you get my reference. There are probably two doctors on the line with us. You're looking at each other. And when we have a situation like that, we understand that seconds really do count. And seconds are so important. And therefore, the Gemara says, if instead of doing what we're supposed to do, if instead of going immediately to the hospital and tending to the one who is ill, we go to the rabbi's house, says the Gemara, HaReze Shofech Damim. Why do I bring this up? Why is it relevant to our discussion? Because there is a major, major controversy when it comes to the local Hatzalah that we have in many of our communities today, here in America and in Israel as well. Why is it relevant? Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and many of the other great poskim of our generation have a major discussion about what happens when I have a member of Hatzalah, or for that matter, a doctor. A member of Hatzalah is a better example. He comes home Friday night, he was on a business trip the whole week, and he finally has an opportunity to spend time with his family. He's sitting down to Kiddush. They eat the challah. And suddenly, he gets a Hatzalah call. He runs out immediately, jumps in his car, goes to the scene, takes the patient to the hospital, waits there until the patient is admitted into the hospital and now is in good hands in the hospital itself. But now what does he do? What is he supposed to do? And this is a major discussion. Does he have a right to now return home? Or would one say, what right would he have to return home? After all, he did his job. He took care of the life-threatening situation. And now he is no longer tending to someone's life. So now, what right does he have to go back home? Now, if we're talking about a situation where we need him back in town because we're concerned that maybe there's going to be another call and he's now going to be able to save another life, then that's not a conversation. Of course we need to take him back. But let's say we live in a community where we have plenty of volunteers. There is no danger to anybody else's life if this one member of Hatzalah is going to stay in the hospital. What right would he have to actually return home? And this is a major discussion, a major controversy that was discussed amongst the great Gedolim of our generation. And Rav Herzog weighed in on the issue as well. And Rav Herzog said, let's leave everything else aside. All the other considerations are irrelevant. He says, let's just focus on this one point. We need to encourage a member of Hatzalah who's volunteering of his time to help lives and to save other people. We need to be able to encourage him to the best of our ability to want to do this the next time around. Now, what's going to happen to a Hatzalah member who, the minute Shabbos starts, gets stuck in the hospital and is there for the next 25 hours? Do you think the next Shabbos, when a call comes in, he's going to have any interest in going? And the answer to that is no. And therefore, says Rav Herzog, because we have to be concerned about that, we need to do whatever we can to encourage him to want to invest of himself the next time that this situation presents itself. And that is very much based on the Mishnah that we just read. When you have farmers who are expending their energy, who are taking time, who are taking their effort, and who are going out of their way to do something, to perform a mitzvah, we need to do whatever we can to try and encourage them to do this the next time around. And by doing so, by allowing this Hatzalah member to come back, that is part of our encouragement to that Hatzalah member to want to be able to do this the next time around. Let me give another example that's a very common example. The Raman Shulchan Aruch in Hilchas Tzedakah talks about a person who decides to give tzedakah, but he decides that he wants to do it for his own self-aggrandizement. He wants to try and flaunt his wealth, and he wants to flaunt what a great tzaddik he is by giving charity. And this is a question that is discussed in the Rama. Do I have a right to give charity, but to give it almost conditionally and to say, of course I'm happy to contribute, but I expect some recognition in response for that which I have given? So the Shulchan Aruch discusses this, and he writes in Siman Reish Mem Tes in Yeravadeya, Lo yispar adam bitzdaka shehu nosei. We should not be of that kind of mindset. We should not flaunt or broadcast the charity that we give, the philanthropic gifts that we are involved with. We should keep it quiet, because that is the right way to give charity. That is what the Shulchan Aruch says, and this is based on a Gemara Maseches Ksubos. And there the Gemara tells us an unfortunate story about Nachdimon Ben Gurion. The Gemara there tells us that Nachdimon Ben Gurion was a major philanthropist in Yerushalayim, and ultimately his entire family became needy. His entire family was not able to sustain themselves. And the question is why? And the Gemara says, because everything that he gave, all the contributions that he made to the world, were all lechvodo hu de'avid. He did it all for himself. He had no interest for the betterment of the community. It was all just to further promote himself. And therefore the Gemara says, he was punished. He was punished miserably. And the Shulchan Aruch says, from there we learn that one is not supposed to flaunt the charitable givings that they are involved with. It is better that it should remain quiet. So if that is the case, I would imagine that many of us here on the call tonight have been to a shul before. I imagine I'm not the only one who's been to a synagogue or to a school or to a yeshiva or to a seminary or to a library or to any other charitable giving. And I'm sure we have noticed that there are people who celebrate their parents, their grandparents, themselves, their children, their in-laws, whoever it might be. How are they allowed to do that? Shulchan Aruch says that this is something that should be avoided. And after all, we know the story about Nachdiman Ben Gurion, Lechvodo Hu David. So how is it that we put people's names when they give charitable contributions if, after all, this seems to be very much against the spirit of how charity is supposed to be given out? And the answer the Rama there writes in the name of the Rashba is because let's just all think about human nature. How can we justify this custom? How can we defend it? The answer is very simple. As we know, if we encourage people by giving them a little bit of kavod, that goes a very long way. And that will encourage others to want to do the very same. That will encourage others that in the future, if they have thoughts about being charitable, about doing something for the Tovas HaKlal, they will also be encouraged to do it. We all like a little bit of kavod, and therefore the Shulchan Aruch says, although it's not at all the right thing to do, the justification that we have for doing so is simply because we know that by doing so, we will encourage them to do it again in the future. And therefore the Rashba says, V'ra'uy la'asos kein. Not only are we allowed to do it, we are encouraged to do that as well. And that is all learned from our Mishnah here in Maseches Bikurim. When you have somebody who's doing something that is difficult for them to do, when you have somebody who's going way out of their way to perform a mitzvah, we should go out of our way to respect them and to show them that we encourage their efforts and we hope that they will do it again in the future. That is reason number one why we stand up and go out of our way for the farmers who travel to Yerushalayim for the mitzvah of Bikurim. Reason number two that is given is because chaviva mitzvah b'shaita, which means, as the Gemara says, we want to show our appreciation, our respect for a mitzvah that is being performed. You know, I always wonder, we go to a levaya, and sometimes we unfortunately attend a levaya of somebody we were friendly with, but I don't know, in life itself, when that person walked into a room, I never stood up for that individual. He wasn't that honorable. He didn't deserve that much respect. He was a friend of mine. I didn't stand up every time he walked into the room. Isn't it strange? Suddenly we come la'achar me'eva esrim shana, and we wheel in the casket, we wheel in the aron, and they make an announcement, everybody please rise. Why are we rising? Why are we standing up? In the person's own lifetime, we never stood up for them. Why suddenly does the rule change? Why is it worthy of standing up for them now at the end of life? And the answer that the Bartanura gives is based on this Mishnah. It has nothing at all to do with the fact that we have so much respect for this person. Next time you go to a levaya, Rachmana Litzlan, understand that the reason why you're standing up is not for the niftar or nifteres, it's not for the mace, but rather for the chevra kadisha. Because they are engaged in a mitzvah, and because they're doing a chesed shel emes, therefore we stand up for them chaviva mitzvah b'shaita. We stand up for them because they are in the midst of performing a very important mitzvah. It goes beyond that. The Bartanura writes, you ever wonder, we come to a bris, and they call out, Kvater, we're about to start the bris, and everybody stands up. Why are you standing up? What has this child done in his life that deserves us to give him honor? And the answer is, we're not standing up for the child. The child has actually done nothing in his life. I would have said, the child also has done no wrong in his life, and maybe that's a good reason to stand up, but that's not the reason. The reason we stand up is because the parents and those who are carrying the child are worthy of being respected because they are about to perform a very important mitzvah. And because of that, we stand up in their honor. Chaviva mitzvah b'shaita. We want to show how much respect and dignity we give to one who is in the performance of a mitzvah. It's the same reason why we stand up when a chassan and kala walk down the aisle. Some people think the reason we stand up is because chassan doma lemelech. It's not exactly true. Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, when a chassan or kala walk down the aisle, they're not yet married. Chassan doma lemelech means after he gets married, he is considered like a melech. After the kala gets married, she is like a malka. You know, Rav Pam once said, parenthetically, how long can a chassan and kala say that they have the status of a melech or a malka? How long can a chassan doma lemelech apply? And Rav Pam, the Rosh Hashiva of Torah Vadas, responded, as long as the man treats his wife like a queen, he still has the status of a chassan doma lemelech. So, that can be the whole life. But be it as it may, why do we stand up for a chassan and kala when they walk down the aisle? The answer, said Rav Soloveitchik, is because they're on their way to perform a very important mitzvah. And as a result of that, we show respect for what it is that they're about to do. It's the same reason we stand up for the people who are performing the mitzvah of Bris Milah. It's the same reason we stand up for the people who are members of the Chevra Kadisha, who are helping out with the mitzvah of Kvuras HaMeis. And this is all derived from our Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim that mentions the idea of standing up for the farmers as they approach the city of Yerushalayim. Now let's move on to another point in the Mishnah, as you'll notice. And it's an interesting point that the Mishnah raises, and that is, as the farmers descend onto Yerushalayim, we know, the Mishnah says, that they would have a great fanfare that was celebrating their entry into the city of Yerushalayim. However, the Mishnah says, "Lefi kavod hanechnasim hayu yotzim." Depending on how important, how prominent the farmer was, that's the kind of communal reception that they received. And the Yerushalmi asks a question, and it's a penetrating question. V'chiyesh katan v'gadol b'Yisrael. Do you mean to tell me that we have a hierarchy in Judaism? Do you mean to tell me that there are more prominent members and there are less prominent members? Do you think that somebody is considered to be distinguished and somebody else is considered to be ordinary? What does that mean? After all, says the Yerushalmi, all of them are coming to perform the same mitzvah. So what's the difference between one farmer and the other? They all deserve the same amount of respect. There's a very amusing story that's told in the Shari Tshuva. It's in Hilchos Dalad Minim. The Shari Tshuva, there's one Shari Tshuva written by Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the Rishonim, and that is a Musar Sefer, a Sefer on Hashkafa. The Shari Tshuva in the Shulchan Aruch is written by one of the Achronim, and that is where he has an amazing story, where he talks about one community in Europe that on Sukkot, the rabbi was davening in the front of the shul, and suddenly he turns around and he hears a major commotion in the background. Couldn't figure out what was going on. And he walks to the back of the shul and he asks, what's happening? Why is everybody fighting? And he finds out that what happened was, that year, there was a shortage of lulavim and esrogim. People were not able to get lulavim and esrogim. There was one individual in the town, a big veer, who figured out how to get himself a set of dalad minim. And he came to shul and he was so proud. And he shows up by halal and he whips it out of the bag. And he's standing there in front of the whole community and he's shaking his dalad minim and he's so excited. And people in the community started to yell at him and they said, how embarrassing. You got yourself a set of dalad minim, that's wonderful. But how is it that you don't share it with the rabbi? After all, the rabbi is the most distinguished member of our community. How do you not give the rabbi the chance to use the dalad minim? How are you saving it for yourself? And he turns back to them and he says, why would I give it to the rabbi? I mean, I love him and all, and I think we should respect him, but after all, I went out of my way to find the dalad minim, so I should be able to use it. Why would I give it to him? And this fight broke out in the back of shul, and the rabbi finally comes to the back and he asks, what's going on here? And they tell him, and they say, rabbi, tell us who's correct. Now that's putting the rabbi in a very difficult position. Whatever he says, he's got to be wrong. Because if he says, it belongs to me, if he says, I have rights, that sounds very inappropriate for a rabbi to say about himself. If he says, I don't have rights, it sounds like false humility. So he doesn't know exactly what to do, but the rabbi turns to them and he says, this member of the community is 100% right. Why is he right? Because why is my mitzvah more important than his? Both of us were commanded by the same God that we have an obligation to shake the dalad minim. So why is it that I should have more rights to that mitzvah than he? We're both in the same place. We both have the same obligation. And he has the right to take it the same way I do. Why would I have any rights more than him? And that is a very important story. And there the Shari Tshuva explains, when it comes to giving an aliyah, and we have to figure out who's going to get the one aliyah, the answer is there, as a community, we need to decide who is the most honorable person here, who is deserving of an aliyah. And that's why we single somebody out. However, when we talk about a mitzvah that all of us share together, and each individual person needs to do it on their own, in such a case, there's no reason to assume that the rabbi should be more deserving than anybody else who happens to be there. And that is a very important story of the Shari Tshuva. You go 200 or 300 years later, and you come to the Bris Kerov. The Bris Kerov lived in Yerushalayim. On one occasion, the Bris Kerov was having a bris for one of his grandchildren, and he had many, many distinguished Rabbanim and notable Torah personalities who were there celebrating the Simcha together with him. And he turns to one of the great distinguished Talmidei Chachamim there and he says, you know, I'd like you to be mechabit all of us by saying a Dvar Torah. I'd like you to share some words here at the Bris Mila. We have many great people here. And the rabbi gets up and he says, thank you very much, Rav Soloveitchik. Of course I'm going to share some Dvar Torah. I came well prepared. I knew there would be a nice gathering here. And he gets up and he says, you know, I'm honored to be here because there are so many distinguished guests and such an august gathering and so many great Talmidei Chachamim and so many tzaddikim. What greater way to celebrate a Bris Mila than this with all these great guests here? And the Bris Kerov turned to him and he said, I thank you very much, but you can sit down now. The man was humiliated and he said, well, what did I say wrong? What happened? And the Brisker Rav turned to him and he said, that is a comment that is an unacceptable one. God gave us all communally a mitzvah of Bris Milah. All of us share it. Just because it happens to be my grandson doesn't make the Bris Milah any more important than anyone else's Bris Milah, than anyone else's mitzvah. And you have the wrong perspective. There is no such thing as katan v'gadol b'Yisrael when it comes to our observance of mitzvos. We do not differentiate. There is no distinction drawn between the most prominent member of the community and what seemed to be the simplest member of our community. All of them have equal rights, equal opportunity, equal obligation to share in that mitzvah. And one final point for our discussion this evening, I don't want to keep anyone too late, though I do see that we have some friends in California, so it's bright and early for you, and it's a pleasure to see your face once again. I hope we'll be able to see ourselves in person very soon. But let me just share the following final point for our discussion, and this too is something that is relevant to our Mishnah that we started with. When offering Bikurim, the first and primary obligation is that the farmer needs to take the first fruits that grow, the first produce, and travel to Yerushalayim and offer them to the Kohen. Upon getting to Yerushalayim, upon entering the Beis HaMikdash, the Gemara tells us that there's an obligation for him to read certain psukim from the Chumash as he presents his Bikurim to the Kohen. Now the problem is, the Mishnah writes, in early days, it used to be, a farmer came to the Beis HaMikdash, he offered his Bikurim to the Kohen, and he recited the psukim. But what would happen when you had a farmer who was illiterate? What would happen when you had a farmer who was uneducated and he wasn't able to say the psukim? He didn't know how to read from a chumash. What would that farmer do when he came to the Beis HaMikdash, when he came to offer his bikurim? And the Gemara says, no problem at all. The Kohen would stand there and he would say word for word from each word of the pasuk, and the farmer would repeat after the Kohen's words. Okay, very easy. But then the Gemara says it became very embarrassing. Imagine, here I am, standing in line, ready to offer my Bikurim. I see the person in front of me online has no problem reading on his own. The person behind me online, I know, has no problem at all. And suddenly, here I am, I'm new, I really don't know how to read, I never went to school, I'm totally uneducated, I'm illiterate, and you're going to tell me I have to humiliate myself by repeating word for word after the Kohen? And the Gemara says, because of that terrible humiliation, farmers stopped coming to the Beis HaMikdash, because they were too embarrassed. I'm not interested in coming if I have to suffer this embarrassment in front of other people. And as a result of that, the Gemara says we changed the system. The system then became that regardless of how well educated you are, regardless of how much Torah you knew and how well you know how to read the Chumash, every farmer that showed up to offer the Bikurim went through the same uniform process. And that was the Kohen said a word and the farmer repeated after him. The Kohen said the next word, and the farmer repeats after, because we don't want anyone to be embarrassed. We want everyone to have the same uniform process when they come to the Beis HaMikdash. So that is what the Mishnah writes. They changed the process, they reformed it, as a result of the embarrassment that happened. You think about it, in the olden days when they used to have Kriyas HaTorah, it worked the same way. When somebody got an aliyah to the Torah, they walked up to the Torah and they had an obligation to read from the Sefer Torah on their own. The problem is, there are many people who get aliyos who don't know how to read, myself included. There are no nekudos in the Torah. The trup is not written in there. I don't know how to read it. And therefore, it became very embarrassing. Nobody wanted to take an aliyah anymore. I don't want to be humiliated in front of the whole congregation. And as a result of that, the Gemara says they changed the process. And from that time on, they have the institution of a Bal Koreh, that he reads for all of us in order not to humiliate the person who does not know how to read. Take for another example. If anyone has ever been to a wedding before, you certainly have noticed that under the chuppah, there are a number of brachos that are recited. Now, who is supposed to recite those brachos? Those brachos are really the obligation of the chasan and kala. After all, they're the ones getting married. So why is it that the rabbi makes the bracha? That seems very strange. The chasan and kala are the ones who should be making the bracha. And the answer is because some chasan and kalas know how to make the bracha. There are others who we will encounter who may not know how to do that. And we don't want to embarrass anybody. We don't want to have any humiliating circumstances where somebody will be ashamed of the fact that they don't know how to read from the sitter. And therefore we made a uniform idea that every time there's a wedding, the rabbi, or whoever it is that's Masada Kedushin, is the one who makes the bracha, because we don't want anyone to be embarrassed. So we have this concept, and we find it so many times throughout halacha. The Gemara tells us about the description of what took place when somebody would pass away in the days of Chazal. Now this is very interesting. The Gemara says it used to be that people were buried in tachrichim, as we do today. They have shrouds. But it used to be in the olden days that you could have the deluxe edition tachrichim, you could have the fancy garnishings on the tachrichim, or you can just have the simple white sheet, the white clothing, the white shrouds that they would bury a person in. That became a very embarrassing moment. Everybody would show up at a levaya and they would see how much money you had. Were you able to afford the gold trimmings on the tachrichim? Were you able to afford the nice garnishings that made your tachrichim nicer? Or did you have to settle with the simple tachrichim that some of the other people had in town? That became very, very embarrassing. And therefore the Gemara says, we made one uniform standard. Everybody is buried in the same tachrichim, nothing fancy. Everybody gets the same thing in order not to humiliate anyone. The Gemara then goes further and says, this is not a new custom that we have today, that when somebody is Rachmana Litzlan sitting Shiva, the family members have all kinds of packages coming into the house. And you have the neighbors baking and cooking and ordering, and everybody has all kinds of things coming to the house. This is not a new phenomenon. This is in the days of Chazal. They already had this idea. They already had this concept. And the Gemara says, this became a very embarrassing time. You see, the Gemara says it used to be that when somebody sat Shiva, if they had a lot of money and they were very wealthy from the upper echelon of their society, then their friends would send them beautiful baskets, beautiful arrangements, and things would be really ornate. And if they were very simple, people would send them, you know, simple, nothing major, nothing too exciting, nothing too fancy. And that became very embarrassing. The Gemara says people stopped sitting Shiva. Because somebody walks into Bibi Nachum Avil, the first thing they do is look in my kitchen. Let's see. Oh, how fancy is it? Let's see how nice the arrangements are that you got. Oh, that tells us a little bit about your background, tells us a little bit about how much money you have, how rich you are, how poor you are. The Gemara says this became a very embarrassing time for everybody, and therefore they decided we're going to have one uniform standard. Everybody gets the same packages when they're sitting Shiva. We don't want to distinguish, we don't want to differentiate, we don't want to single people out, we don't want people staring and looking and talking. And as a result of that, we're going to make one uniform standard. So this is a theme that we find very, very often throughout Chazal, that they have an extreme sensitivity to people's feelings. And Chazal were very concerned that somebody's going to feel like a misfit, that somebody's going to feel uncomfortable. And as a result of that, we need to ask ourselves the question, when it comes to the mitzvah of Bikurim, you had a farmer who showed up to the Beis HaMikdash, and he was a very wealthy farmer. And he would come to the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishnah writes, with gold and silver baskets, and he would present it with a lot of fanfare, and he would show up and give those baskets to the Kohen, and it would be a whole scene, and everybody would be pointing and looking, oh, look what he has, oh, he has a really nice one, he got it from this store, from that store, it's an antique, beautiful. And then you got the farmer right behind him, who's just eking out a living, he doesn't have enough money, he can't buy any of these fancy baskets, and he would show up with a wicker basket, and he would be embarrassed as he shows up, as he inches his way toward the front of the Kohen line, and he would give his wicker basket with the small fruits to the Kohen. He was so ashamed, he was so embarrassed. Why don't we make a uniform standard when it comes to the Bikurim? Why are we suddenly not concerned anymore about people's feelings? How come nobody's worried that the farmer who's standing in back of the line is going to be embarrassed and ashamed by all those who are in front of him, who are offering these beautiful arrangements of Bikurim in gold and silver baskets? Many, many answers are given to this question. What I'd like to share with you is the answer of the Malbim. Malbim lived in the 1800s. He was one of the great Gedolim in Prussia and Romania. And the Malbim has in a Sefer on Chumash an amazing insight to answer this question. Writes the Malbim, the reason why is because Derech ha'ani sha'oseh ba'atzmo ha'tene, the poor person does not take $1,000 and go to the local silver store and buy himself a beautiful basket. He doesn't have the money to afford that. You know what he does? After a long day of work and he's so exhausted and he was out in the burning hot sun and he's sweating and all he wants to do is go to sleep. But he comes home and he reminds himself, in a couple of weeks I need to go to the Beis HaMikdash to bring my Bikurim. And you know what? I can't afford a basket, so what am I going to do? I have to bring the Bikurim in something. And he sits down late at night and he starts trying with his own two hands to put together a wicker basket. and he weaves it, and he toils, and he works so hard to create this basket, and it's so meaningful to him, it's so precious to him. And guess what? When somebody invests of their own time, of their own effort, of their own energy, writes the Malbim, that person has nothing to be ashamed of. That person should be so proud of what it is that they have. That person should stand with pride in line and say, I've given HaKadosh Baruch Hu everything that I have. I've invested of myself and I'm handing it over to the Ribono Shel Olam. And is there going to be somebody in front of me in line or on the side of me in the line who has a gold and silver basket? Maybe. But that's worth nothing compared to what I have done for the Ribono Shel Olam. I can have people all around me who are serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu with gold and silver that has no impact on the life that I live. I gave HaKadosh Baruch Hu everything I have. I invested of myself. I worked hard. I spent money. I expended energy. I stayed up late at nights. I did all of this. I traveled to Yerushalayim. I am so proud of that. And says the Malbim, the Ribono Shel Olam is so proud. And guess what? The Malbim points us to a comment in the Mishnah where it says that the Kohen only used to keep the wicker baskets. But when a Kohen came and he received a basket that was made of gold and silver, he would return the basket back to the farmer. Why? Ask the Malbim. The rich get richer, the poor get poorer. I don't understand. A farmer is rich, he can afford the gold and silver, he hands it over to the Kohen gives it back to him. The farmer who's poor, and he gave everything he had for the wicker basket, the Kohen keeps the basket. Why? Writes the Malbim, because the gold and silver is worth nothing in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu when it's compared to something that somebody worked hard to create. Somebody who works hard and exerts effort, it's not about how beautiful it is, it's about how significant the effort and the energy expended is to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I was talking to somebody a couple of years ago in our neighborhood here in Long Island, and they have a beautiful house, and this person told me that the most meaningful thing that they have in their entire house is a gift that they got from an old housekeeper of theirs, or a babysitter. And they said it came a time where they no longer needed the babysitter. And this was a Hispanic woman who worked with this family for years and became a very close member of the family and was involved in all the family simchas and in all the ups and downs of life, was so involved with the family. And when unfortunately she was not able to come to work anymore for whatever reason, she went and she bought a fake flower, an artificial flower, and she gave it to the hostess who took care of her for so many years. And this woman told me that that is one of the most precious items in her house. And this family has art all over the walls and a beautiful home with marble and all kinds of beautiful adorning things all over the house and every room you go into. But she told me that when she understood how valuable it was to her that this woman took some of the little money that she had, went out of her way, tried to find something that she found meaningful to herself, tried to give and exert energy and effort into the gift that she was giving. There is nothing greater that a person can feel than that feeling itself. That is exactly what the Malbim writes. We have nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to feel bad about. You'll notice that after Shabbos and Yom Tov, we recite Havdalah. We have a mitzvah to recite Kiddush at the beginning, and the bookend at the end is Havdalah. But there is one marked distinction between the Havdalah that we say after Shabbos and Havdalah that we recite after Yom Tov. What is that distinction? Well, there's one aspect of the Havdalah that we leave out. And what is that? After Shabbos, we smell the besamim. After Yom Tov, we do not smell the besamim in Havdalah. And why is that? This is a question of the Rishonim. And Rabbeinu Tam, and Rashi, and the Rashbam, they all discuss this issue in Maseches Beitza. Why is it that we don't smell the besamim after the conclusion of Yom Tov? We only smell the besamim at the conclusion of Shabbos. And the Rishonim debate the issue. Well, why is it that we smell besamim at all? And the Rishonim say the reason why is because we get a neshama yisera when Shabbos comes in. We have some kind of elevated spirit. And when Shabbos ends, that neshama leaves us. And therefore we need to smell the besamim to appease ourselves for the loss of neshama at the conclusion of Shabbos. Well, if that's the case, why do we not have that after Yom Tov as well? And the answer that's given, the Shem Yishmuel explains in the name of the Ramban, that the answer is because Shabbos is kaviyah v'kaima. Shabbos comes every week, whether we like it or not. Whether we prepare for Shabbos or not, we get the Neshama Yisera. It's here. And therefore, writes the Shem Yishmuel in the name of the Ramban, easy come, easy go. You get the Neshama Yisera when Shabbos comes in, your Neshama Yisera leaves when Shabbos ends, and you need the Besamim to appease yourself. When we talk about the experience of Yom Tov, the Gemara says the only way that Yom Tov could be established is if we invest in the Yom Tov. The only way it can happen is if we, as a Jewish people, are Mekadesh the Chodesh. That's the only way Yom Tov will happen. And therefore, since we expended effort and energy to make Yom Tov a reality, that Neshama Yisera that we create on Yom Tov is something that does not leave when Yom Tov is over. There's no reason to smell the Besamim when Yom Tov ends, because that Neshama Yisera that we got, that we were so privileged to get, is something that never leaves us. It's something that stays with us forever. So it's important to think about that as we say in our davening on Yom Tov. On Shabbos, we end off the davening Mekadesh HaShabbos. God is the one who gives sanctity and Kedusha to Shabbos. How do we end the bracha on Yom Tov? Mekadesh Yisrael v'hazmanim. It is the Jewish people who infuse the Zmanim with Kedusha. It is our investment that make Yom Tov a reality. It doesn't happen on its own. It happens only because we exert effort and energy to make Yom Tov a reality. And as a result of that, there is no need to smell the Besamim, because the Neshama Yisera that we create through our effort and through our energy is something that never leaves. The two most significant mountains in all of Jewish history are Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah. Har Sinai and Har HaMoriah. As we know, on Har Sinai, that's where we were given the Torah. It's the most significant place in all of Jewish history. That's where the Jewish people became the Am Segula. That's where God chose us. That's where God, Ve'erastich li li'olam, that's where God married us. That's where He took us in as His children. Ahavti eschem amar Hashem. That happened at the moment of Har Sinai. Har HaMoriah is also a significant mountain. It's where we had the Beis HaMikdash. It's where we hope to have the Beis HaMikdash, the Asid Lavo. It's where Avram Avinu performed the Akedah. Two very significant mountains that we celebrate. And yet you'll notice that one of them has a permanent and everlasting Kedusha, whereas the other one seems not to be relevant at all in our times. Har Sinai, there is no problem at all. There's no prohibition. If somebody were to locate Har Sinai, there would be no prohibition to go up on the mountain. And yet when it comes to Har HaMoriah, when it comes to the Temple Mount, we know that there are all kinds of restrictions. Even today, when there is no Beis HaMikdash, we are restricted, we are limited where we are allowed to go and where we are not. How can that be? There's no Beis HaMikdash today, and it should be the same as Har Sinai. Why should there be any difference? And the answer is, says Rav Soloveitchik, because let's think about the infusion of sanctity into these two mountains. Har Sinai, we showed up at Har Sinai, and God was shore His Shechina. God rested His presence on the mountain. We did nothing to deserve that. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Himself came. He resided on the mountain. And after the experience of Har Sinai was over, He left. And therefore that Kedusha is not an everlasting one. It is not eternal and permanent. When we talk about Har HaMoriah, how did that Kedusha come to be? What was the sanctity that made Har HaMoriah the place that it is, that makes Har HaBayis the place that we know it to be? Why is it that Har HaBayis, even today, is a place where we are not allowed to go, where it's off limits for the most part? The answer is because Avram Avinu sacrificed there. Because Avram Avinu gave so much to invest and to endow the place with Kedusha. Because he infused it with all the sanctity that it has. And after Avram Avinu's time, Jews for so many millennia came there and sacrificed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They gave up so much of themselves. That is what creates sanctity in the world. And when sanctity is created through our endurance, when sanctity is created through our efforts, through our investment, that is a Kedusha that never wanes. That is a Kedusha that is everlasting. That is something that is with us forever. That is the holiest and most dignified place that one will ever be in their lives. And that is so much greater than even the historic place of Har Sinai. That, says Rav Soloveitchik, is what we celebrate as we come to a Shavuos, as we think about what the Torah means to us. We think not only about the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu endowed us v'chaye olam natab esochenu, which is such an amazing gift, which is such a profound blessing that all of us have in our lives, but we think about what that means for all of us. We think about our investment. We think about the responsibility that we have as Jews to carry that gift and to use it and to invest of ourselves, to infuse our world with sanctity and with holiness, to allow ourselves the gift of appreciating this incredible blessing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, and to always remember that whatever it is that we invest, whatever it is that we give, is an investment in our own eternity. It will be with us forever. There is no besamim amatzoi yamtif. There is besamim amatzoi Shabbos. Because that which we invest in creating, that which we work hard to build, is something that is with us forever and ever. I wish all of you a Chag Sameach. I thank you all for joining us. A most meaningful and uplifting Shabbos. And I look forward to having many, many more future opportunities to learning with all of you together, either in person or via Zoom once again. Good Shabbos to all of you.